The Midweek Drive Team, four words which signify quality and all that's best in audio entertainment.
Food allergies, you might well say they're the bane of the 21st century, but they've been around before that, of course, and we are particularly disturbed to actually find that mislabeled and unclear food packaging has actually caused allergic reactions for half of UK sufferers. Now, to actually talk about some possible solutions to this and how to actually address this particular issue, we're delighted to welcome two fine folk. First of all, the Chief Executive Officer of Creative Nature Superfoods, that's Julianne Ponan. How are you, Julianne?
Very well, thank you. Excited to be talking about this topic.
Excellent. And we also have a non-executive director from GS1 UK, that's Sarah Atkins. How are you, Sarah?
Good morning, Alex. How are you?
Very good indeed. Now, let's turn to your good self first, Julianne, if we may. You're a sufferer of anaphylaxis, which obviously is with reference to all nuts, some seeds and certain additives, etc. So from your own particular experience, you are particularly aware of the dangers of mislabeled and unclear food packaging. Can you just share with us your own kind of experience in this whole field?
Yes, sure. So I guess unclear labeling is the bane of my life. It takes me as a person with allergies so long to shop anyway for a product. And I've had numerous anaphylactic attacks where I've tried a product that I've tried for years, however then the labeling has changed or it's been wrong and I've unfortunately gone into an anaphylactic reaction and been rushed to hospital,
which is not good in any shape or form. Sarah, as non-executive director from GS1 UK, you are indeed attempting to use technology to actually pilot what we see as the next generation barcodes. So can you just explain what it is and how this can actually help Julianne from actually suffering, or indeed others suffering from mislabeled packaging and so on?
Yeah, I think we can start with the fact that from the survey that we've just conducted, over 60% of people rely on that product packaging. And I don't know how you find it, Alex, but unless I've got my glasses and I'm in the supermarket, it's virtually impossible to work out what's physically there. And the guidance around may contain and all of that is not legislated. So it's no wonder that there's a huge degree of unclear waters when it comes to this. So what we're looking to do at GS1 UK, we're the organisation that is infamous for the barcode, infrastructure that's been supporting us in retail for the last 50 years, is merging that technology, which identifies a specific product, linking it with the internet, and making a whole raft of additional information available to the consumer via our mobile phone. So we've all seen QR codes have arrived out of nowhere as a result of COVID, and those QR codes do a great job in terms of directing you to a marketing message or a menu, but we think they can do something much more powerful when linked to an individual product. So those QR codes powered by GS1 will go off to the internet and they will hunt all that allergen information down that Julianne and lots of people like her need in order to provide them accurate, up-to-date, which is another topic of conversation, information. And we know that 60% of people rely on that packaging information. And we know that if there's a QR code there, then the vast majority of them will scan it to find more. And we want to make sure that all of that information is there for them with this new QR code powered by us.
I see that allergy sufferers are also 2.5 times more likely than non-allergy sufferers to have their purchasing decisions influenced by the availability of detailed product information via their QR code. So it's got a business ramification as well, presumably for companies who are producing foodstuffs as well. Julianne, from what you've heard, is this the panacea? Is this the magic bullet? Or is it a case of, well, it's a step in the right direction, but there's still a way to go?
I definitely think it's a step because it really does extend far beyond like the limitations of the physical packaging, but it can be updated by manufacturers real time, making the allergen information more accurate and accessible than ever before. So I do think this is a fantastic step in the right direction, but it's whether manufacturers are going to update that information. That will be the next question.
And in terms of the technology, sir, I mean, obviously it goes without saying it presupposes people do actually have access to a smartphone and that obviously it's on a platform which is accessible to folk, whatever their state of play happens to be. Are those things in place? I mean, is this a case of, well, it's all very good if you've got a smartphone, but if you haven't, well, tough, you're just going to have to gamble.
Obviously, the prevalence of smartphones has significantly expanded. And by collecting this information, we believe it's going to improve the quality of what's actually there. And what we're finding is there are lots of really innovative apps out there that are helping individuals that may be challenged when it comes to reading information. So those that are partially sighted, there are apps now that, yes, they are dependent on a mobile, but by pointing the mobile at the QR code, the information can be read to them. So we do believe it's going to have a huge impact in terms of driving accessibility to that quality information.
Julianne from Creative Nature Superfoods Routine, do you think that more legislation is required? Because clearly there are food manufacturers who do sometimes try to, if not necessarily go over the line, push as far as possible to the line. I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the notion of may contain nuts is a classic example. Or do you think that actually, as this QR code system is rolled out, that things will become to a natural state of play?
I think there does need to be more legislation. There's a huge problem in free from aisles at the moment. When you're diagnosed, the first place you go is the free from aisle to get food that you can physically eat. However, it's riddled with alibi labeling of may contain, and so many vegan products are sitting in free from. They say vegan on the front and then may contain milk and egg or animal products on the back, which is a huge problem for someone that is allergic to dairy, for example, because recently there's been a survey where it was tested that 1 in 3 out of those products actually contained milk, which is a huge issue. But I think that the QR code will serve a purpose in being able to give that information to the consumer quicker, because you'll be able to explain as a brand how you've vetted your factory, how you've vetted your suppliers, like what are the steps that you're doing as a manufacturer to ensure that product is truly safe and truly free from for the consumer.
And of course, there is the other aspect of brand contamination, that certainly with gluten-free products, you just need to have a slight smidgen of non-gluten product and the whole thing can be contaminated. But presumably that's something to be sorted out in the manufacturing processes.
Yeah, so the legal limit for gluten, there is one which is under 20 parts per million. So as long as you're testing to that, you are allowed to claim gluten-free. However, of course, as you said, if there is a cross-contamination, there would need to be a recall. And being able to do that through a QR code for the consumer, that would be very, very helpful.
Sarah, how can people actually find out more about GSI, or GS1, I should say, UK?
So really simple, power of the internet. So gs1uk.org. And we've got all of the details of the research that's physically on there, including, you know, some of the facts around the fact that that may contain information that Julianne's just picked up. It's purely a voluntary code at this moment in time. So we believe that it also, as the technology evolves, not only is it going to help consumers, but it will help the retailers, to the recall point that Julianne's just put. So if it can, it will go beep at the till in the future. And therefore, if it is a recall, instead of it being, you know, we've all seen those pieces of paper on the windows in the supermarket saying this is recall, it can actually be in a situation in the non too distant future that if a recall product hits a till, then it will actually come up and alert the cashier not to actually sell that product to the consumer. So there's lots of ways, because it works for the consumer and it works in the supply chain, that we think the QR is going to be the next huge transformation in the retail space over the next few years.
And Julianne, for Creative Nature Superfoods, do you also have a web address or a link that people can go to?
Yes, it's creativenaturesuperfoods.com.
Excellent. And they're very, very yummy.
Oh, product endorsement from GS. Fantastic stuff. Sarah Adkins, non-executive director from GS1 UK, and Julianne Bonan, CEO of Creative Nature Superfoods, which apparently are very, very yummy. Many thanks indeed. Take care.
Thanks ever so much.
Thank you.
So how do we actually progress with respect to the entrepreneurial agenda? I mean, it's mentioned in higher education, it's mentioned around the country. Entrepreneurship is good. But what are the two most important factors in terms of actually getting that growth to the fore? Well, we've got not just one, but two fabulous folk to actually address this particular issue. First of all, Professor Patricia Riddle, consultant neuroscientist professor and expert on the neuroscience of leadership. How are you, Patricia?
I'm very well. Thanks, Alex.
Excellent. And we also have the managing director of SME Simply Lunch. That's the fabulous Sam Page. How are you, Sam?
I'm very well. Thank you very
Excellent.
much.
Patricia, if we can come to you first, innovation and a clear vision would seem to be the most important factors for growth, according to entrepreneurs. Are those two words which are easily said or easier said than actually implemented?
That's a really great question. And I think it is, that's very true. Innovation, I think sometimes is quite accidental. So sometimes the product comes before the entrepreneurship and people fall into entrepreneurship rather than it being planned. Really having a vision, really being able to, I think, commit to that vision. So I think there's some personal qualities that are really required for entrepreneurs too. What's your attitude to risk? How much work are you prepared to put in?
And those are clearly tying into the whole work-life balance. I mean, Sam, just talk to us about SME Simply Lunch. Is it small, medium enterprise Simply Lunch or something even more significant?
No, I'd say it's an SME, but we're on a strong growth journey as a business. But as it stands, we're a nationwide supplier of food to go products, and we employ 400 people in the local area in South London. But we've got big aspirations, but I'd still say yes, we're an SME.
Okay. Now, I suspect, unless you're under a very good fitness regime, that you're actually under 35. Is that right?
Oh, just 35. Yes, I'm
Right.
36 years old. 36
So
years old.
literally on that cusp of those folk who are apparently more likely to take on higher levels of personal risk than those who are over 55. Has there been any sense of being concerned about when you've been developing Simply Lunch? Any sort of moments where you thought, am I doing the right thing here?
Probably every day, actually, Alex. It's risk it needs to be managed. And I think I look back over some of the decisions that we've made over our a history at Simply Lunch, and I look back and I think, wow, how that was such a brave decision. But at the time, you just feel like it's the right thing to do. You weigh up all of your options to get to where you want to get to. But definitely looking back, you think, would I do that now? But I often think that being brave and naivety sometimes work together. And I certainly think a dose of naivety, being an entrepreneur and trying to grow a business, certainly helps you make certain decisions.
Patricia, in the higher educational sector, there are notorious examples of where the casino has been gambled and institutions have come a cropper. Thankfully, not too often, but when they do actually fall, they do fall mightily. Is this an area whereby you can actually teach risk management, or is it a case of if you look at the neuroscience of leadership, you have that constant battle that Sam's very eloquently put there in terms of how do you actually square the circle between, okay, we'll take a gamble, but it needs to be an informed one?
Yeah, well, I think there's two things actually. One is that that younger people take more risk anyway, and it's to do with the development of the brain. So they're just more aware of opportunity than they are of risk, and therefore they sometimes gamble more. So I think there's a developmental progression there. But can you teach it? Yes, and I think it's about really getting people to understand. Well, more about the consistency, the reputation that you need to build, things like that that will make a difference in the long run, rather than just thinking, well, I've got a great product, let's go with this.
Have you had a chance to look at the HSBC Business Growth Survey with the Top Entrepreneur Insights for 2024 as yet?
I have, yes.
And what are the key things that stand out for yourself in terms of are we doomed, or is it a case of, well, I don't know, there may be some green shoots of recovery, to use a cliched phrase?
I think there will always be entrepreneurs, and I think in any environment you're going to see them come through. And it might even be that the more challenging the environment, the more people turn to entrepreneurship as a way of creating money. So I absolutely believe that we will see more entrepreneurs in the future.
Sam, obviously COVID had a major impact on Simply Lunch, but the fact that you've survived and indeed seem to be thriving post-COVID is a good lesson, and presumably keeping your nerve and keeping on.
Certainly, Alex. COVID reduced our business by about 92% in April 2020. It was a very humbling experience for a business that had been in business for 40 years at that point. And to lose pretty much everything you'd built within about a week was quite a humbling time for us. But we really did, in times of chaos, there's an opportunity, and it's about frame of mind. It's about looking at things in the right way. And after a couple of weeks of trying to understand what's going on, we've totally changed our frame of mind. We said, this is going to be the making of the company. We're going to attack the situation. We're going to survive, and we're going to grow out of this. We're going to look back and go, you'd never ever want this to happen again, but this is going to be the making of Simply Lunch. And luckily for us, we've now trebled the size of the business pre-COVID numbers. We're very happy with how the business is progressing, coming out of COVID.
And is that, Patricia, a classic example of how you can put into practice the notion that failure is not falling down, failure is staying down, the needs to keep on going, no matter how challenging circumstances might be?
I absolutely agree with this. Yes, and one of the things I think came out in the survey is the need for adaptability and agility. There are always going to be obstacles that you cannot predict. And so being able to actually face those head on and say, well, what can we do differently? How do we come around this? Treating things as almost like an opportunity rather than a challenge. What can we do differently now that we're facing this challenge, and how can we help that? How can we make sure that the business survives through that?
With respect to leadership, is it important that in many ways you have an upbeat, optimistic note, and that you do adopt openness policies, transparent policies, and actually share with your stakeholders and indeed workforce the challenges? In many ways, the sort of things that Sam said there, when you are in times of difficulty, you do actually point out a possible rosy future that's there as well.
Completely. I mean, if you want to build a team, if you start hiding things from them, or if they recognize that you've got an agenda that you're not sharing with them, you're not going to get the commitment from your team that you need. So being open, honest, being accountable too, so noticing when your mistakes are causing the problem, being a little bit humble, I think, is our huge benefits in leadership.
And where can people go to find out further details about this HSBC survey, Patricia? Presumably go to the HSBC website.
I think that's exactly where we go. Yes,
That's fine.
I have the data, and I'll probably post something on my website, which is www.patriciariddle.com. So when we've done the analysis, there'll be something up there too, but the HSBC website will be the first place to go.
Okay. And Sam, for Simply Lunch, people wish to actually invest or actually avail themselves of your services, where would you point them?
So best to head to our website, www.simplylunch.co.uk, but we're all on all social media platforms, and our products are across various sites nationwide.
I'm delighted we managed to get through the whole piece without mentioning the word pivot, which was so popular during the pandemic era that I kind of thought it became almost a cliche, but there we are. Sam Page, Managing Director of Simply Lunch, and Professor Patricia Riddle, huge thanks and keep on keeping on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That siren radio, turn up everyone, save a siren sound.
Siren radio.
Come link into Miami, Paris to LA. Our global community wants to hear it play. Students participate, keep on keeping on, keep on keeping on,
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping on,
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping on,
Siren Radio,
keep on keeping on.
Island Radio.
Time for more movie thoughts, reviews, and royal commentary from Richard Fitzwilliams and Natasha Wanton on the Midweek Drive.
I want people to hear my voice.
No, no, no.
And just forget their troubles for 5 minutes.
No, no, no.
Do you know what girl power means to me? Sarah Vaughan, Lauryn Hill. You need to know this. I ain't no Spice Girl.
From primary school.
No, no, no.
To sell out concerts.
It's going to happen one of these days. Voice like yours, got to.
But it's one of the best I've ever heard.
That's my daughter. That's my Amy.
I met someone tonight.
Stay lucky, Amy.
Got an eye for the bad boys.
The album's number one around the world. The highest charting album from a British female artist in the US. Ever.
I don't think I was put on this earth just to sing. I want to be a wife. I want to be a mum.
Probably run off with someone famous anyway.
You're my heartbeat, you're my soul. I love you.
My tears dry.
I don't bang out 10 hits by lunch. I need to live my songs. So that's what I'm going to go and do.
Ready?
I don't write songs to be famous. I write songs because I've got to make something good out of something bad.
Yeah, I don't know what Richard's going to say about the Amy Winehouse biopic. Could be positive, could be negative, could be a case of, well, it's better than Jean Dubarry. Mind you, most things will be better than Jean Dubarry in terms of a line of historical accuracy. But let's not go there. Richard, would you like to go into this biopic of the awesome Amy Winehouse, who, of course, kept the line going of if you're a rock star and a rebellious pop singer and so on, 27 years of age is pretty much the greatest amount you can actually aim for after 27. That's it. It's all gone. You might as well sort of just not be there.
Well, but Alex, are we not early? Others have not joined us.
Natasha's with us. You're with us. The important thing is we can progress onwards with respect to this particular epic. So carry on, Richard.
Well, I would say firstly, I mean, the two films that we're discussing, Back to Back and Jean Dubarry, one of the things that I would mention first, and it's important, I think it has affected the way people view them, and that is both of them, for one reason or another, have been mired in controversy. Now, it's important to mention, so far as Amy Winehouse is concerned, I am not knowledgeable. I knew, of course, of her tragic death, and indeed, I have to say that this film has really divided critics. There's no question that the Standard, I mean, almost an entire edition of the front page of the Standard and the review inside that was highlighted. This film, said the reviewer, made me, quote, gasp in horror, and it launched a vituperative attack on it. So far as the accuracies of the movie, because apparently her state was involved in this, and the portrayals of both Blake, her husband, and also her father, Mitch, both of those portrayals are those who think that they are far, far too favourable. But I just mentioned this to say that there are very much two sides to the way one views films. For example, Jean Dubarry, here's the extraordinary thing. It Johnny Depp's comeback. Now, we all know, and indeed, I mean, very, very few court cases have had the extraordinary publicity that the Johnny Depp versus Amber Heard cases have had, and there have been two of them. This has nothing to do, of course, with the merit of the film, but it does affect the way that it is perceived, because it's come into so many reviews, and also the fact that, so far as Jean de Barry is concerned, it was the opening film of the Cannes Film Festival, but they seem to take a different line to Me Too and other aspects of
Johnny Depp speaks French. That's all we need to know. He doesn't do it very well, he doesn't do it for very long, but he does speak French. That's the important thing.
There was a 7-minute standing ovation, apparently, at Cannes for it. But I mention these just to give an indication of the fact that there has been a lot of controversy surrounding both films for different reasons. Now, Back to Black is directed by Sam Taylor Johnson. She made Nowhere Boy about John Lennon's adolescence, starring Aaron Taylor Johnson, which was much praised. This, the tragic story of the singer Amy Winehouse, who became somewhat of a legend. Well, scenes of her background, the Jewish family, her father Mitch, played by Eddie Marsan, very good actor. It may very well be, and it has been claimed by many, that it's an over-favourable portrayal, but certainly I would say that it was relatively benign. Then there's her grandmother Nan, or Cynthia, played by Leslie Manville, another fine performer. She meets Blake, played by Jack O'Connell, in a pub in Camden Town. They fall in love. He's a cocaine addict. She's an alcoholic and bulimic. And there are problems.
It could be the plot of EastEnders, really, Richard, if it wasn't so true to life.
Well, Alex, of course, it, as you know, is deeply tragic the way this proceeds. Blake has a girlfriend, Becky, wants to stay with her. Then we see Amy's grandmother becomes very ill. She visits New York. Back to Black, the famous album, comes out. Then she reconciles with Blake, much to her father's dismay, and he's arrested and serves 2 years in jail, and then tells Amy, who's now a drug addict, she wants a divorce. She accepts rehab. Again, there's been some controversy over that. She receives 5 Grammys. Then we see her at home at Camden Town trying to tackle her alcoholic dependence when photographers reveal Blake has a new girlfriend and will be having a baby. Tragic things happen. I do not speak, as I've emphasized, as someone who knew much about Amy Winehouse's life, personal life. I'm not actually a great admirer. It doesn't of her singing. It just doesn't have songs.
Are you saying no, Richard? Are you saying you're not going to listen to Amy Winehouse? No, no, no.
What I'm saying, Alex, is that it seemed to me a perfectly reasonable film. Marisa Abella gave a rather touching performance as the troubled singer, I thought. Jack O'Connell, a very fine actor, as Blake. It may well be more favourable than he was entitled to in the opinion of some, but I thought it was good. Eddie Marsan has never turned in a bad performance in his life. The merits of the script, its accuracy, this is not a matter for me. But nonetheless, I'd go for a sort of 6-ish out of 10 for the 6 to 7. I thought it was a very able biopic, and it's directed by someone who I think has integrity. And as I have tried to be fair in stressing the fact that there has been huge controversy and also a lot of critics didn't like it.
Natasha Wanton, are you an Amy Winehouse fan? Is this the kind of movie which you feel does justice to her legacy, or is it a case of, well, she should have gone to rehab after all?
I don't actually know much about Amy Winehouse's life. I obviously would be able to name a handful of maybe some of the more famous songs, but it's not a career, music career that I've particularly followed. I have heard some interesting things sort of just looking into the movie. I know that there was a bit of controversy. Some of close friends have spoken out and said that they think it's an inaccurate portrayal of her. and they weren't happy with some of the ways in which she was represented. Other people have thought some of the representations were a little bit distasteful. But then I've also seen some people who have commented that they like the actress and actress's performance. So it's a bit, I know as Richard said, it is a bit controversial, this movie. I'm not
as
sure
controversial as Jean de Barry, but still, we'll come on to that.
I'm not sure it's one that I would particularly rush to see, just because there's not that musical interest. It's not something for me like Bohemian Rhapsody or
Rocket Man,
where I'm sort of more interested in the musical aspect of it.
Jessica Burtis, as an American currently based in Cambridge, doing your grand tour from France, Paris to Cambridge now, to wherever you happen to be. You might be back in London, I don't know. What are your thoughts on Back to Black? Is it one for you?
To be honest, I don't listen to Amy Winehouse. I mean, I know her name, but I don't really know her music. I think biopics can be very interesting, and they're, I think, a fascinating kind of way to meet someone that you might not know very much about. But I think this one sounds very intense. That was a roller coaster that Richard was saying. I think just going from... they met in Camden Town, and he's a cocaine addict. It was just quite the sentence. So I don't know if this would be the kind of film for me. I think to see this, you might want to be in a good place mentally. So I think,
unlike Amy Winehouse, of course. But there we are. That's another issue.
So I don't know that it's a film. Lately I've been wanting more like cheerful films. I think this one definitely would need a place where you can like sit with it and really think about it. I don't think it's the kind of just like family fun movie you put on to have an uplifting Friday night. But I think it's still important.
Lauren Hobson, a feel-good movie for yourself? Or is it a case of, no, I'm not sure. You know, is this the sort of movie you like to use to celebrate the end of your successful first year as a journalism undergraduate at the University of Lincoln?
Well, yeah, I think, it might be a bit sad to watch for the end of my first year, but I'm a very theatre kid at heart, so I like all the musical things. I'm not a very Amy Winehouse fan, I'll just listen to her on the radio, but I quite like the adaptations. It's mostly just, yeah, there's quite a lot of controversy if it's not done right, and then, yeah. But I think I'd watch it, and I think I'd enjoy it, because I like that sort of thing.
Anna Koshkinel, your thoughts, please.
Well, I think maybe what they tried to do in this film was take a look on her addiction and put it in a different light. And maybe they didn't succeed because they tried to do it in a good way, but it just didn't turn out how they were expecting. I'm on the same page as Jessica and probably Natasha. I don't really listen to Amy Winehouse. I know her popular songs. And I could really use some cheerful movies right now. So probably maybe later. But yeah, she was a great singer. And probably she deserves a movie made after her that's better, not so controversial.
Well, so you talk about controversy, etc. Let's take My Win as an example. Somebody who decided that, yes, I shall do a bit of vanity casting and cast myself in the role of a young girl, 33 years sort of younger than I am, in my mid-40s or whatever, or indeed have a relationship with a king who, and again, it's difficult to actually suss out whether Johnny Depp's character of the King of France is indeed 33 years older than Jean de Barry, who, of course, was blonde, not brunette. But apart from those historical slight minor essences, as you say, a standing ovation, Richard. Johnny Depp speaks French. He's back. Not in black, but he is back. Clearly this could be a whole new world for Johnny Depp doing languages in French. Is it so much Jean de Florette? No, but Jean de Barry? Yes, oui.
Well, it's a mixture, Alex. It's a curious movie. I mentioned firstly, there's even more controversy now, not just over Depp, but also it's directed, co-written and produced by the controversial actress Mae Wynn. Now, Mae Wynn's views on Me Too are not particularly fashionable, and also happens that she gave an interview to The Independent and said that the had... whilst the movie was being made, they'd found Johnny Depp scary and all sorts of... As I say, there's been a tremendous amount written about this and also about the bits about its historical accuracy, the real Jean de Barry. there. It sounds absolutely fascinating. A mistress of Louis the 15th who ended up on the guillotine. But we don't see that. The film ends when the king dies. There's no doubt that it's a flawed movie, but it's also got some extremely interesting aspects to it. There's a very irritating commentary, which was a complete mistake. There's a sort of picture book beginning where we're introduced to how she grew up. She was an illegitimate daughter of a seamstress, catapulted to fame as the courtesan turned countess, who was the favourite mistress of Louis the 15th. And this is a scandalous affair. It certainly was, that rocked the French court. Indeed, to the extent that Marie Antoinette married to the Dauphin, Louis's son, and he had a most unhappy ending, as of course she did, as Madame du Barry did subsequently, refused to speak to her because of her background. What this shows, certainly, and here's one of the problems the film has. On the one hand, you've got Versailles and some of the sets and the costumes and the scenes, whether it's at a levee where the king meets the Countess du Barry, or whether it's this weird business, it's not explained why, and it should have been, where the king has to be dressed by so many top nobles. The whole idea actually was historically that the aristocracy caused trouble for the king, so you get them to Versailles and they perform these sort of, you know, poo-poots on the king's shirt, who shaves the king, sort of thing. But it had actually had a
purpose. As King Charles rarely dresses himself, Richard. It's the same thing, basically.
Alex, you know, that's the sort of point that you pick up on instantly. I mean, there are some...
I'm just speaking of somebody who does dress himself, thank the Lord, and you know, but I've never quite understood the sort of notion of why you actually, if you're a member of the monarchy, have to have somebody dress yourself for you.
Well, here you have it. At Versailles, I'd have been completely at home. The only trouble was, Alex, I suspect you like hot food, and the kitchens were so far away from the dining areas that the food was invariably cold when people got it. The magnificent settings on the one hand, and this is impressive, the costumes, the sets, the scenes of hunting and so forth, that side of it is very, very interesting to those of us, and as a royal commentator these days, it's very interesting to have a peep into pre-revolutionary France. But also, of course, it's absolutely sclerotic. It's utterly weird how nobody could, for example, when you retreated from the king, you couldn't turn your back on him, so you had to do ridiculous almost a sort of dance. The Countess du Barry, or Jean du Barry, doesn't do that. I mean, the point, however, is... I thought Johnny Depp, I hardly recognised him. I've seen him as the Earl of Rochester in The Libertine.
That's what a relationship with Amber Heard can do for you, Richard.
Well, that's possible, Alex. I take no sides in the court case on the theory. I lift myself above it. No. The problem my winner's got is that I didn't find her a particularly appealing character, which...
Is there no chemistry between Mai Wen and Johnny, then?
It's adequate. The film leaves you with a sort of rather empty feel. Now, that's curious. Depp's performance, I thought, was rather good, because he's playing a king who's got to keep up appearances, which he does, but on the other hand, he's got an interesting side to him that he chooses a courtesan who clearly makes him happy. So there is the love... It's undoubtedly, or was undoubtedly, real. I didn't personally find Mai Wen especially appealing, which I think we were meant to, because she was as feminist as the era allows. She was married to an abusive count, there was a scene where he's abusive. It's quite interesting. I felt rather distant from the film, but it is rather impressive. And it ends with, as I mentioned, when the king dies. It is extraordinary. And it's interesting to read up as to what happens subsequently. And one scene, a black page, Zamor, played by Jibril Gimo, is gifted from the king to to Jean du Barry. The problem turned out to be that it was he who finally betrayed her to the revolutionaries. Apparently, the excuse was that she helped those who they wanted to catch to escape. But true or not, this is a visually spectacular movie. It lacks magnetism, and certainly, I mean, Maywenn apparently studied films like Barry Lyndon, which was absolutely magical, and you were drawn into the
She
era.
was very impressed with Sofia Coppola's work in Marie Antoinette.
Yes, but I wasn't particularly impressed by Marie Antoinette. I'm a great admirer of Sofia Coppola, particularly Lost in Translation, and I mean, recently Priscilla was. Had interesting aspect to it, but what we see here, yes, I'm glad I saw it. It's curiously embalmed. It needed something. I can't help feeling it was the fact that, and I'm not alone in this. A lot of critics weren't drawn to Maywenn's performance. It's a perfectly adequate performance, though. Somehow the movie doesn't come alive. There's some very good performances, especially the valet and confidant of Du Barry's. Played by Melvin Poupard, who inducts her into the
There's more
bizarre.
chemistry between the valet and Maywenn than there actually is between Depp and Maywenn.
Yes, I would go along with that to some extent, but on the other hand, it's easy to mock and remember the one thing the film didn't want if you take away is that you know the glories of Versailles. I mean, we know very well what that led to and why, but equally, what it led to was the terror and dreadful repression, and then that led to Napoleon. So, if you want to continue the history lesson, it's pretty terrifying. But yes, I enjoyed it. No, I didn't feel particularly involved in it. I probably should have been, but I did think that was rather good. And I thought Maywenn, well, it was the king's type, not mine. There it is.
Jean de Barry, not to be confused with Gareth Barry, of course, player from Aston Villa, the current favourite football team of the Prince of Wales. But there we are.
Alex.
It's a connection. Jessica, Jean de Barry, a 33-year gap between the two main leads, supposedly. In reality, probably about 7 or 8 years. What are your thoughts, Jessica? Is it a case of if it's got Johnny Depp in, it must be awesome?
Well, I mean, to be honest, I'm kind of a sucker for any movie involving royalty from that period. I think it's so interesting. The drama was so intricate. Like, we think about the gossip shows now, but I feel like it can't compare to the gossip back then. Also, sorry for the background ambiance of the cars. But I think I would like to watch it. The age gap sounds a bit weird, but I feel like that's very normal, unfortunately, in Hollywood. But I would be curious to see it because, like I said, if nothing else, I like the aesthetics of that period, which maybe isn't the point of it, but it is what it is.
And where exactly are you today, Jessica?
I am walking down a street in Cambridge because we're going punting, which in the US means kicking a football,
Yeah,
and
no.
apparently here it means boats, so I'm
Yeah.
excited.
Yeah. It's all down to physics. It's the art of Newtonian physics, basically. Action and reaction. You make sure that the pole is sufficiently sort of pressed down on as you gradually pass your way in the punt across and along the River Cam. Best work, best advice I can give you, Jessica, is let somebody be the punter. You just sit in the boats and look graceful. That's all I'm saying. Anna Coscarnell, is this one for yourself? Not punting, so to speak, but so which of course in English could also mean having a punt, having a gamble, basically, which is another gamble. Or is it a case of no, Maywenn is not my favorite actress?
So the first time I saw the poster and picture of this movie, I did not realize that was Johnny Depp. So when Richard said that it doesn't look like him, I agreed so much. He doesn't. But usually I love every single movie that has him and I love watching them. And it's a romance movie. And as Jessica said earlier, everything that was going on back then, it's so interesting how they put it in light. So probably I will watch it because who doesn't like some romance and drama at the same time, and who doesn't like romance when Johnny Depp is involved? So, yes.
And of course, technically, the real Jean de Barry was indeed a blonde and not a brunette. But why should we worry about such things at the end of the day? Murren, is this one for you?
I think so. I mean, as Richard was saying, it's very visually appealing. All the colours and sets seem amazing. And I think it's quite refreshing to see Johnny Depp in like a different role. Usually you've seen him like quite, I don't know if brooding's a word, but you know, you've got like Jack Sparrow, he's always got dark hair, tattoos, everything like that. But yeah, no, I think it seems good. There's always kind of like a consequence if you the director goes into a film. Sometimes it works well because they know the film very well, but sometimes it might not work and that can kind of lead to it not going as well. But no, it seems good. Yeah.
Yeah, one wonders actually with respect to the small amount of French that Depp actually says, why they didn't actually do as they used to frequently do with characters like Gert Frobe, for instance, Goldfinger, back in the day, where you could actually just have his voice dubbed by a French actor, as opposed to him actually struggling through the French language, which apparently several speeches were cut because he was having difficulty with respect to the whole thing. As I like to say, les hommes ont rire, non pas d'histoire. Happy people don't make history. Natasha, is this something which you feel, yes, I like my history. I find Johnny Depp interesting. It's time to see how he relates to May Wynne.
That's a very depressing quote you just quoted there, Alex, as well. Look, I'm in two minds about this one. I, as you know yourself, Alex, and as Richard knows, I really love my historical movies. Now, I'm quite
Pirates of the
particular
Caribbean.
with.
Historically accurate all the way.
Oh, yes. I am a bit particular at times with historical accuracy and believability, but generally I can kind of circumvent that if I form an attachment and if I find the characters and the actress and actresses performances convincing enough. So I can kind of either it needs to be like really historically accurate, or I'm sort of drawn in by the characters. Now, this seems like I'm not going to be drawn in by the characters, or at least certainly from the leading lady's performance, which might be a bit frustrating for me because I feel like I'm not going to get that connection. Therefore, I'm sort of relying on the sort of the historical sort of what I'm getting from it, which apparently is going to be a bit interesting according to Richard's examples he's given as well. So I'm not sure if I'm going to find this movie frustrating. I'm a bit sad to hear that Richard said he found it a bit empty and he couldn't connect with it, but it might just be have to be one of my movies that I watch on a plane when I'm going somewhere and I just look at all the prettiness and I don't need to hear what's going on. But I will probably save it for that setting alone. I'm probably wouldn't rush to it for the reasons I stated.
Could be alternate history though, or taking place in another dimension, the same dimension which led to Napoleon actually sending cannibals to the Sphinx, which also apparently didn't happen. But there we are, that's just another line entirely. It's different historical times in the multiverse. Is it an 8 out of 10 for you, Richard, for this?
I think 7, Alex. 8 puts it, I would feel more involved, but I mean, I did enjoy
Standing
the whole
ovation at
film.
Cannes.
That was the case, but I mean, the fact they chose that as the opening film, as I say, is symbolic of a very interesting way the French are handling things, and if you contrast it with Hollywood and so forth. I'd also like, Alex, to touch on the very interesting moral questions, the ethical issues of the play Nachtland, if we have time.
Well, I think so. If Natasha can actually hold off on her footballing scenario with a New Zealand director for one more week, then Richard, you can go into the land of the night.
Well, the Nachtland, it's a play that was written at the Young Vic, directed by Patrick Marber, who did the marvelous movie of Sexual Politics in London, or play in the late 90s, and it was made into a film with Julia Roberts and Clive Owen, Closer. And this is a very, very interesting play. It also poses some fascinating questions. Now, if you were, well, say that there are a couple of siblings, Nicola and Philip, and their father dies. And they go into the loft, and this is the thing, you meet on the stage, they're clearing the various possessions of their father, as one does or would in that circumstance. They come across an old painting from the 1930s or 20s, and this is to be signed by an Ahiller, and then it's noticed that one of those L's is actually a T. Well, could this be a work by the infamous monster Hitler himself? Firstly, it's important to get someone who will certify that this is a genuine Hitler painting. And when they discover that it is, or appears to be, the person concerned's grandfather was in charge in the 1930s of Hitler's art. Well, what would you do? Would you keep it, as Philip wants to do? Would you destroy it? His wife Judith is very definitely into destroying it, as well she might be given her background. Or would you sell it? The character
Well, let's
instantly.
just put that to the team, Richard. Marin, if you found a portrait allegedly done by Adolf Hitler in the areas of one of your contacts, etc., would you keep it? Would you sell it? Or would you actually destroy it?
I definitely wouldn't keep it. I don't know what I'd do. I mean, I'd probably give it to like a museum or something. I mean, like, you take it, do whatever you want. But yeah, I think I'd get rid of it.
Yeah, Natasha, keep, sell, or destroy?
Donate.
Yeah,
Probably donate it
it's like
to.
snog, marry, avoid. You know, we're looking at the same sort of scenario here. Keep,
Yeah,
destroy, or
probably
sell.
in terms of sell, in terms of like, in terms of you can give me some money towards a charity or something that, you know, if you can donate money to charity and I will give you the painting or something, I don't know, something like that, a historical museum. I think it's interesting to have it, not necessarily to promote him and his work, because you obviously don't want to give him that spotlight, but I think in terms of in giving insight into, you know, his mind and stuff, it might be quite interesting for historians for historical purposes.
Anna Koskinel, keep, destroy, or sell? And we just need to unmute you, otherwise we'll have challenges there. I think we're having various peeps there. So keep, destroy, or sell?
For sure not destroy. Probably, as Natasha said, donate.
Okay, Dana. All right, Jessica. Any thoughts on yourself? Well, what would you actually do?
I think I would also donate it to a museum. I don't think I would keep it or sell it at all.
So there we are, Richard. In essence, it's donate, which wasn't sadly one of the options that they give in this play.
Oh, well, that's true, Alec. But one of the interesting aspects of it is that in deciding to look at its value, some very, very dodgy issues come up. Firstly, the way the past can affect the present and how the family is, in fact, haunted by what happened in the 1930s. And secondly, it puts the spotlight on the relationships in the family, which, putting it mildly, are not improved or certainly drastically changed by this. And also, in deciding to look into its value, various problems of the Germany's present come up in the links with the far right and also with those linked with Nazi memorabilia. It was fascinating. I don't know if anyone else has ever had this experience, and that wasn't usually in when one goes to plays. If somebody falls ill, there is an understudy. In this particular case, a fascinating play, incidentally, and quite provocative, well acted, but acted. A character who drops out, well, a replacement has to read from notes. Now, that is distracting and certainly not desirable. I haven't had this experience before. However, it's as a piece, and it's Marius von Meyerberg is the playwright. I look forward to seeing others' plays he's written if they come here, because it was fascinating to put the family under this sort of microscope, especially considering the hatreds and the problems and what happens in the past and
It's
what
always
act.
problematic, Richard, when you have Nazis in the family. I'm just saying, you know.
It is indeed, Alex, and strange things. There's some interesting little twists on the path to discovery in this.
Well, you know, surely it's a case of next girl wins, which will be a case of next week wins, actually, Natasha. Do you want to actually just trail ahead to why we should all be checking out Next Girl Wins? And I know Richard's such a passionate follower of football since, of course, Aston Villa was revealed to be the team of the Prince of Wales. You know, off you go, Natasha.
Look, I'm not going to sell you this is the best movie you've ever seen since sliced bread, but I've heard some requests from the girls, and they were saying they want something happy, they want something feel good, they want something that's going to make them smile. So it's available on Disney Plus. It was out in the cinemas, but it's now free for viewing if you have Disney Plus. And it's only 1 hour and 40 minutes. And you know what? It made me smile. That's your little teaser.
There we are. Next up, Next Girl Wins next week, as far as the film segment is actually concerned. For now, to Marion Hobson, to Jessica Burtis, don't fall in the water, Jessica, Anna Coscunnell, and Natasha Wanton, huge thanks. I think we might have Theo Vandenbogart back from Germany next week, and maybe even Sarah Huntley as well. But remember, keep watching those movies.
Siren Radio.
What a scenario without Siren Radio. Stand up, everyone, save our siren sound. From Lincoln to Miami, Paris to LA, our global community wants to hear it play.
Siren Radio.
Let them all create, students participate. Keep on keeping on. Save our siren radio.